It's another Wildlife Wednesday on the show, and we are going to get an update on what animals to look for and why it's best sometimes to leave them alone. Larry Mueller here, and a couple of our regular guests for you. Jamie Knack, one of them. Jamie is an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Jamie, good to see you.
Nice to see you too, Larry.
And with us, he's not personally with us. He normally is. David Drake. David's a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. And David, welcome to have you back as well. Thanks for joining in from your long-distance area.
Yes, thank you, Larry. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, at my favorite conference I attend, which is the International Urban Wildlife Conference. Just got done giving a talk, so it's nice to catch up with you and Jamie and the listeners.
Yeah, as we listen to these two talk, I hope you'll join in. Join the conversation with your questions or comments. Maybe you've got a wildlife photo Jamie can take a look at because she's right here in the studio. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org with your question or maybe your wildlife photo. And I tell you what, David, since you're at that conference, and it has to do with urban wildlife, coyotes seem to be on the rise of the sightings of them. Are urban coyote populations increasing?
That is a good question, Larry. I don't know that they're increasing, but they certainly seem to be more visible lately. And especially here in Madison, as you know, we've talked about a project that we've got going on here, the UW Urban Canid Project in Madison. And I know we've got more reports of coyotes being seen during the day. They are raising pups right now, so they're a little bit more active and a little bit more defensive and territorial than they would be other times of the year. Thankfully, we have not received reports about coyote aggression toward people or dogs, so that's a good thing. But we just want to make sure people are aware that right now coyotes are raising their pups, and if you know of an active den in an area, whether it be urban or not, or out in the country, give them space. Certainly don't bring your dog around that area because that dog will likely trigger a more aggressive response from a coyote than if you don't have a dog nearby. So we just want to make sure people are aware of that. And again, this, you know, we're talking about coyotes now, but obviously we're in the spring season, and that is the season that the vast, vast majority of wildlife are having young right now. And we just want to make people aware that give the young space, give the adults some space, observe them from a distance, but try to be as little intrusive or not intrusive at all if you can.
And as I understand it, you're looking for roadkill coyotes, raccoons, skunks, and opossums.
Yeah, that's right.
And most people don't want much to do with them. Why are you looking for them?
I know. We are with some colleagues in our department, Dr. Wendy Turner, who's with the U.S. Geological Survey Cooperative Unit, one of her research scientists, Marie Gilbertson, and a veterinarian on campus, Dr. Julia Neighbor. We are starting to collect preliminary data on anticoagulant rodenticide exposure or rat poison exposure in small mammals and predators and scavengers. And so we are interested in looking at road-killed animals. And fortunately, our Wisconsin Department of Natural Resource permit for collection is only in Dane County and Iowa County. So if you have other reports outside those two counties, unfortunately, we'd be interested, but we can't collect there. But what we are doing is collecting livers from road-killed animals and then submitting those livers to the Iowa State University Vet Diagnostic Lab for rodenticide testing. And we've contributed some livers already tested, and we found at least one, if not three, different types of second-generation rodenticides in 57% of the coyote livers we tested, 50% of the possum livers, 33% of the raccoon livers, which to us was low. We submitted one mink, so they had a rodenticide, and we submitted two red fox, and they both had rodenticide exposure. So
wow.
It's a project we're starting to look at. We want to start tying rodenticide exposure to disease prevalence. We want to look at rodenticide exposure across the landscape to see if it's consistent or variable depending on socioeconomic factors or different environmental factors. And so it's a project we're starting up and very, very interested in, and this sounds weird, but we were very, very excited to find rhodenticide exposure. We didn't think we would not, but we found it, and we want to keep looking for it.
Well, let's talk about live animals for a minute, Jamie. May through June is turtle nesting season in Wisconsin, and that means more turtles crossing roads from low-flying wet areas to lay their eggs. What should people do if they encounter a turtle in a roadway?
Yeah, so this is a group of wildlife in Wisconsin that could really use our help. And I say that because we have only 11 species of turtles, and 4 of those species are threatened, endangered, or of special concern in the state. And part of that is their ability to reproduce has been hindered. And so whether it be road mortality, which is what we're talking about here, so getting run over by a vehicle, predation, so nest predation. They don't have any parental, they don't protect their nest. They lay the eggs, cover them back up, and leave. And so there's a lot of animals that predate turtle nests. And then also on a grander scale, habitat loss and fragmentation of the habitat. And also there is an illegal pet trade where turtles are collected and sold. And so all of these kind of work together to make it difficult on turtle reproduction. Not to mention that breeding ages, I bet you a lot of people don't know this, but for a Blanding's turtle or a wood turtle, females have to reach 12 to 20 years old before they start to be breeders in the population. So that's a lot of time.
It's a long time.
In the environment before they can even replace themselves. And so to answer your question, if you do see a turtle at this time of the year crossing a road, we don't know whether it already laid eggs and is on its return trip or it's on the trip to go and lay those eggs in an upland area. Best advice, first and foremost, is your safety. It has to be a safe opportunity to intervene. If you deem it is safe, you can pull over, put your hazards on, and move that turtle across the road in the direction it was going. If it is a painted turtle, a small turtle, you can pick it up and set it on the other side. If it's something like a snapping turtle, you want to give it some respect and some distance. You can either find a larger stick and kind of scoot it across. Sometimes you'll get it to clasp onto that stick and then you can kind of drag it across. But bottom line, take it in the direction it was already going on its own. It knows where it's headed. So,
okay. It knows where it's going. Gary in Milwaukee has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Gary.
Oh, hello. So I have a question about, you mentioned the bird count at the beginning of the show, and I have a question about the greater Canada goose, the one that's kind of a nuisance in the state. I have an interest in asking this. I have a place on a relatively small lake in central Wisconsin. It's 88 acres. The drainage isn't the best. And come fall, huge flocks of these geese make it their home, and they stay until ice forces them off. And come spring, the water quality in this lake has just plummeted in terms of algae. And I've been on the lake for 65 years. It was never that way before. And we also didn't have huge flocks of geese in fall either early on in that time. And so I'm wondering how the numbers are for these geese in the state. We have a lake meeting coming up at the end of the month. We're going to try to encourage these birds to move on when they land in fall. But I'm wondering if you have any comment on that or on the numbers or if the birds are still a bit of a nuisance.
Let's go to Jamie for that. Jamie?
Yeah, I don't have any specific numbers, although Canada geese are doing quite well. And we do have concerns with resident geese, so that tend to spend longer periods of time in a local area, as you said, until that particular lake freezes over and they're pushed further south. So there are some things you can do to try to harass or move them on. But I think another opportunity would be to work with that lakes association and your local biologist, or even reaching out to wildlife services. So they're a branch of the USDA wildlife services that deal with nuisance wildlife or mitigating human wildlife conflict. And they may have some suggestions from a lake owner's perspective collaboratively how you might handle that. And then I think working with a local Department of Natural Resource water quality specialist, you might be able to get some testing done and see, you know, exactly what is the impact or the perceived impact. Is it the geese? Is it fertilizers that are being used on lawns? Is there some work that could be done on the shoreline to have a more natural shoreline landscape? Really kind of look at that local situation.
Yeah, it could be a combination of a lot of things there, as you point out.
Yep.
Gary, does that help out?
It does. We've thought of it being a combination as well, because the lawns around the lake are very green and getting bigger. And I know some people treat it, so we're going to address that situation, too, come the end of the month.
That sounds good.
Gary, if you do a little bit of internet Googling or searching, I would look for resources for native shoreline restoration. And maybe those are some materials that could be shared with the homeowners.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll mention, all good things, Jamie and Larry, you've mentioned, but the other thing is, especially if you those houses are on septic systems and the septic systems are older, that they will leak. And sometimes that will get into the water as well and create some water pollution and eutrophication issues. So maybe check that as well.
Yeah, easy. I can remember somebody telling me they wondered about their septic and they put some dye in the toilet, and it was it flushed the toilet, and it was already coming out into the water.
Oh, geez.
They could see it.
Wow.
And, by the time they got down to the water. So,
wow.
Scary.
Yeah. So that's something else to think about, Gary, for sure. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests, you have a question or comment as we talk wildlife with them. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking Wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Nack. Great to have them back with us today. Eugene and Viola emailed us at talk@wpr.org to say that Eugene keeps a spade in his truck to move turtles off the road. So that's a good way to do it. Wendy and Madison emailed to say that in the past couple of weeks, they found a couple of dead birds and two dead bats. And Wendy says they never knew if, when, or how to report any deaths. Any guidance would be very appreciated. And Jamie, do you want to?
Sure. Wendy, in lieu of a number in front of me, I would suggest calling the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources 1-800 number. It'll be on their homepage of their website. And so they run a switchboard, so there will be somebody to answer that call and then get that information to you. And so in the past with disease concerns or mortality events, usually it's just like thinking about West Nile virus and some of the previous events, avian influenza, they usually will have a guideline of if you see five or more dead birds in a specific area, then to report and to collect. Now with those bats, there might be some interest there too. And so I would suggest calling that 1-800 number through the DNR and asking them what the current procedures are. I think it goes without saying, but don't handle any of those animals without latex gloves and double bagging typically, but they should be able to tell you whether those carcasses should be refrigerated and from there.
Yeah, that makes very, very good sense. And mentioning bats, David, there's a bat count. The Great Wisconsin Bat Count is this month, if I'm not mistaken. How does this citizen science project work?
Yeah, so it is. It actually starts today's Wednesday. It starts this Friday through Sunday. But cave bats are back at their summer roosts, and they're in bat houses, outbuildings, barns, other places like that. And so the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is asking volunteers and landowners to go out and count bats this Friday night, Saturday night, or Sunday night at sunset as bats are emerging from those roosts. You can count one night or you can count both nights, more than one night if you wish to. And then they would like you to count again July 18th through the 20th, so roughly 5 weeks later. And this helps the DNR gauge bat population trends in the summer. So that early count, the count that will be this weekend, is known as prevalency count. And so it means that it will occur before the newborn bat pups have started flying. So the bats are having the young now. That second count, July 18th through the 20th, is post-volency, and it's after the bats have started flying. So it gives the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources a sense about what does reproduction look like for this year, because obviously that later count in July, the more bats you see would be an indication of the amount of reproduction that's going on this summer. And so here's what the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources would like you to do. If you're willing to do this, and I know that all of us would suggest that you do this because it's very helpful for the bats. It's a super cool, fun thing to do as a family with kids, things like that. But find a spot where you think or know that bats roost, be it a house or a building or a bat box. And then go out. You can only count, well, you only need to count one night if you want, but the more nights you count, the better in each of the pre and post-volency. So around sunset, you'd go out and you're going to count the number of bats that you see emerging as they are coming out of that roost. And in addition to counting bats, what they would like you to also do is provide information on the roost site. So where's the site located? What type of a roost is? Is it a bat box? Is it an attic that are coming out of from behind perhaps your shutters in the front of your house? Weather conditions at the time of the count. And then counts generally take 20 to 30 minutes for each night. And you can go to the Wisconsin Bat Program website. So if you just Google Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bat Program, you can find a online form where you can submit your counts. But encourage you to do this. It is super easy, fun, especially if it's a nice evening out. You know, grab a bottle of wine and your date and go out and have a time of it.
Okay. Sounds like a plan to me. The wonder, I guess, is why do we count them, or what's the value of, and why is a healthy bat population important?
Yeah, so those are all good questions. A healthy bat population is important for a whole host of reasons. But number one, obviously, we've talked a lot about this on this program, and your listeners probably have heard this other places. But we've got this fungal disease called white nose syndrome that is attacking cave bats, or the bats that are hibernating over the winter here in Wisconsin. Those bat populations are declining pretty precipitously. And with that decline, there was a really cool study that was published a couple years ago where they looked at white nose syndrome as it spread across the country. And as white nose syndrome started to attack the bat populations and they saw a decline in the bat populations, they were also seeing in those areas an increase in the amount of pesticides that farmers were having to apply to their crops. And in those areas where they saw an increase in pesticide due to the decline in bat populations, they were also seeing an increase, not a great increase, but it was an increase nonetheless, in the infant mortality. So bats are a natural controller of pesticide or insects. They're pollinator species in some parts of the world. They are a native species that adds to our biodiversity. A lot of people enjoy seeing them. So those are all reasons why to keep them around. And there's not a lot known about bats. So we don't know much about the demographics of bats in terms of what percentage of the young actually enter adulthood each year, or what the mortality rate is, or how long they live necessarily, because there's a lot of things that will kill bats. From, we talked about the fungal disease, but predators, wind turbines, and a whole host of other things like that. So there's not a lot known about bats. The more that it can be found out, the more data that can be collected, the more management that can occur to sustain the conservation of bats, not only in our state, but also throughout the country and worldwide.
David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Terry and John in Sun Prairie emailed photos of a leucistic grackle in town. And it's like the head of the bird is pretty much completely white, Jamie.
Yeah, and it does look like those are feathers. I was kind of getting close to see if that was feather loss or white feathers, but they do appear to be white feathers. And the coloring, the white coloring, is only on the head from what I can see. So just a, you know, variation, as they said, a little bit leucistic qualities showing up there. Very interesting.
Yeah, and another note, going back to reporting sick or dead wild mammals, you were talking about it, the DNR wildlife switchboard at wisconsin.gov, you can send that in, or the number to call is 608-267-0866, and you can leave a message for the switchboard staff.
Perfect.
For that.
Yeah,
so there
thank
we
you.
Go. It's again at 608-267-0866. Joe in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hi, hello.
What's on your mind?
Are wild pigs a problem in Wisconsin?
Yeah. Are wild pigs a problem in Wisconsin? Certainly that's come up over off and on over the years.
Yep. So in the past, a number of years ago, we did have wild pig reports. I'm sure there were other counties, but Crawford County was one of them. And there was a big call out to hunters and landowners to help reduce that population, not a species that we want to have established in the state. So a number of southern states do have very big problems with feral hogs or feral pigs. They don't just graze vegetation, but they root around. So they disturb the soil to get at the roots and just completely wreak havoc on the habitat. And so there's some hunting potential there that is of interest to some people, but in terms of what they do for habitat destruction, just not a species and not a native species to Wisconsin either. To get to the caller's question, I have not heard of any sightings of late, although Wildlife Services would be the folks that would be on top of that if there have been, because they're the ones that are often brought in to eradicate them as soon as they are detected.
Yeah.
Jamie, right. My understanding is that the wild pigs have been eradicated, and they were primarily focused around the southwestern part of the state, Crawford County, like you said, and some neighboring counties. But my understanding as of 2 years ago that there are no longer wild pigs and feral pigs in Wisconsin.
That's a good thing.
Yep, all right. For sure.
Phyllis in Winona, Minnesota, what's on your mind?
Hello. I've been thinking about putting up a bat house or maybe two. I live in a residential area. I'm wondering if that's a recommended thing, and if so, where would be the best place for me to place it?
Yeah,
good question, Phyllis. And thank you for thinking of the bats. So now is really the time, you know, they probably have a lot of their summer roosts set up. Not that you couldn't go ahead and erect one now, but you also have some time to do research and to look at whether you're going to purchase a bat house or if you're going to have, you know, build your own over the winter. But typically with the bat houses, you want those on a pole, mounted on a pole rather than a tree, because that helps with reducing predation. And then also these bats are insectivores, so they're flying around catching insects. And, you know, really want that bat house kind of more in an open area where they can fly and enter. And then also near water, doesn't have to be right next to water, but within a quarter mile or so of water is also a good idea. I would say in a suburban or urban setting, it's not a bad idea to talk to your neighbors. My family lives out in the country, and our neighbors were not real happy about us putting up bat houses, which it surprises me because we have a lot of wetlands, and so there are the mosquitoes and insects, but they had a unfounded concern about bats in general. So after some conversation, I think they're more open to it, but it doesn't hurt to have a conversation if you've got close neighbors. But otherwise, there are some excellent resources. I'm sure Minnesota has their own, but the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bat Program has an excellent publication on building a bat house, and then also tips for where to install them in northern climates like Wisconsin, like the Midwest. They're typically recommending that they're painted brown or black so that they absorb more of that sun, the sun's energy and the heat. If you're in the southern part of the country, you certainly don't want that dark colored bat house. So some things like that to consider. And again, lots of great information out there from your extension office or from your state fish and wildlife agencies.
I'll just mention two quick things, Larry and Jamie. All good points, Jamie. I agree with you 100%. Generally, if you can orient the face of the bat house toward the south, if you can't do that, orient toward the east because it's better solar or sun exposure. And in addition to the wonderful resources Jamie mentioned, there's also Bat Conservation International, which is this awesome clearinghouse for bat research and advocacy. And they've got a fabulous frequently asked questions page about bat houses. And if you can't find things in Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources or Minnesota, go there and I guarantee you, you'll find what you need.
And we had a question relating to the bat counts, and somebody wondered why do you do it two times? And I think it has to do with the newborn pups, right?
Yeah, you're really estimating what the reproduction looks like. So as David mentioned, the first count is occurring. So a lot of the bats that nest in, have their summer roosts, nest in colonies, those females will have one, maybe two pups. And so they have pretty slow reproductive potential or low reproductive potential. And so what they're doing is the count is when the adults are leaving to go and feed, leaving the pups in the roost. And then the later count, 5 or 6 weeks later, those pups are now flying themselves and they are leaving. So we can subtract the difference and get a general estimate of what that reproduction looks like in that specific roost.
Jane in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jane.
Hello. I actually have two questions, but I'll make them real short. I live across from an urban wetland. It's quite small, and a sandhill crane visits there. And recently I saw a red-winged blackbird dive-bombing the crane and landed on the crane's back. And I was wondering, is that like the blackbird just being territorial, or do cranes, would cranes eat eggs, bird eggs?
And that is simply the blackbird not playing well with its bird friends. Blackbirds are notoriously territorial, especially around nests, and cranes are obviously nesting in those same wetland complexes. And cranes are moving around, feeding, doing whatever they're doing. And that crane was just too close, likely, to a blackbird nest.
Yeah, I remember a few years back getting bopped on the back of my head when they walked by. I thought, what the heck?
And, yep, too close.
I was too close to their nest.
Yeah.
So, Jane, thank you for calling. Pete in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Pete.
All right, thank you, Larry. I appreciate it. You're most excellent. So last 2 weekends ago, the 24th of May, I was canoeing along the picnic point, and I discovered a kingfisher entangled in feet and feet of fishing line. It took me 20 minutes to disentangle this poor bird. It was a couple of really brand new lures, beautiful lures, and I feel like we love our fishers. There's so much pressure on the going fishing, and people fish too close to the shore and just keep tossing those lures, and they abandoned the tackle, just hanging there. And it was like all this line, and the poor bird was probably trying to die for some, you know, to feed, and it got entangled his right wing. I was just hanging there, died. It was really fresh. The bird was still very flexible, wasn't stiff, and I just felt really sad about that. So just if you could bring up the fact that lures, abandoned lures kill.
Yeah,
and fishing line as well. So the tangling from the fishing line. So, yeah. Well, thank you for intervening. And I think that's just a good take home message for everybody: is to, even if it's not yours, if you come across fishing line, litter, all of those things, lures.
Take a minute and
take a minute and pick them up. So yeah. I forgot the gentleman's name, but I've been following
up.
Oh, well, I meant I was following a Facebook post of a diver, a gentleman who scuba dives at boat landings and around our area, around the state. And then we'll have, you know, there'd be cell phones and bottles and just the amount of garbage that people don't think twice about throwing into the lake. It's really sad. So we can all do our part.
As we're talking about this fishing, might as well also mention, do not use lead weights and sinkers either, because that's affecting diving ducks and loons and things of that nature. There's enough research now that they're showing that they're ingesting that lead and it's having a negative impact on their health.
Yep.
All good points. And Pete, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve in the Lake Tomahawk area has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for putting me on. Couple of things. You were talking about citizen participation and counts and so on. I just wanted to make people aware that Marshfield Survey.
Oh, I'm sorry. Marshfield Clinic you're talking about.
Yes. Yeah, they're doing a tick survey. I think part of the purpose is to map the range of the different species. They're also doing some diagnostic stuff. So they could contact the Marshfield Clinic website if they want to get involved in a tick survey. And the other thing was somebody mentioned geese and pollution in lakes. I know we keep our shore pretty deep, thick grass, fairly natural. In fact, very natural. And we see a lot of the geese attracted to the more humanized shorelines, as I think one of your experts commented on. And I'd like to just verify that. They don't seem to want to come to shore. They don't seem to occupy shore.
Yeah, they don't.
So there's, you know, sometimes people will, you know, mow all the way to the water's edge. And you know, we're really trying to promote natural shorelines for amphibians, reptiles, small mammals, you name it, that natural shoreline. If you just think about frogs or turtles, you know, that makes them so vulnerable to predation, and it really takes away that habitat for them. But from a Canada geese standpoint, they generally are entering the lawn from the water. And with having longer vegetation, they're less likely to kind of walk through that to come into that green grass. And so the more of that backyard or lawn that's approaching the water's edge that you can have in a natural setting, I think the less likely you'll have geese choosing your lawn to loaf for the day.
Yeah, I was thinking about we had a lake home on Lake Monona, and we had tall grass, and the neighbor did too, but not the neighbor beyond, and that's where all the geese went to the other neighbor.
Yep.
I saw 15 or 20 Canada geese on that lawn, and I thought, boy, I'm glad I'm not going to have to mow that lawn.
Yes, yep.
So, as Steve, thanks very much, and also for the information on the Marshfield Clinic Tick Survey.
Yes.
Something to think about there as well. Owen in Cornucopia emailed a photo they took of a fisher in their area. Owen is curious if fishers pose any danger to people. He was in the Cornucopia area, and he's got a pretty good photo of a fisher.
Yeah, I'll jump in on this one. But so fishers were native to Wisconsin and then extirpated. So kind of wiped out, depleted, not extinct, but no longer in our state during European settlement. And then the Department of Natural Resources started reintroducing fisher as a native species, like in the 70s, through a couple of reintroductions. And now fisher have responded really well to that. And we find them in the northern and central forests of the state. But also, it's not uncommon to have sightings in the southwest part of the state as well. And so what I would say to that is it's still pretty rare to see a fisher. The ones that I have seen, it is just a little glimpse of them, maybe running up a fallen tree and just bounding through the forest, but they don't stick around very long, and I'd consider yourself lucky to see them, and personally would not be concerned about them being aggressive or anything like that. I think just being able to see one in Wisconsin would be a really cool occurrence.
I got to watch one for about a half an hour during deer season one year, and it was really a lot of fun to watch them, how they move and everything, and eat and everything else.
Yeah, and if it knew you were there, I'm sure it would be gone.
It was up in a tree at the time.
Yeah.
So you can join in too, by the way. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800- 642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our wildlife specialists, with us today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us for WPR News. Larry Mueller here with David Drake and Jamie Nack, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist is David, and a professor in the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Jamie Nack, a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, and she is also affiliated with Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Let's take a call. Mary Jo in Wausau has something for us. Hi, Mary Jo.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. In the middle of Lake Wausau is a heron rookery, and my friend and I have been watching it for about 15 years. We watch them come in the spring when there aren't any leaves on the trees. They modify and improve their nest and then have quite a large number of chicks, or I think they're called chicks. But anyway, this year it seems that there are a lot fewer herons. I can't see the nests any longer because of the leaves, but they're, usually we would see a lot of them flying around as they go out to feed. And I'm wondering if the rookery is about to fail.
Do you know anything about that, David?
That's a good question. Up by where Jamie lives, on the way to Jamie's house, there used to be a wonderful heron rookery in a wooded kind of wetland section between, is that 151, Jamie, or Highway 51? Which one is that?
Yep, 151.
151. And I know Jamie and I would always comment on that because we'd see the rookery as we were driving north, or Jamie would see it probably every day she would drive home. And this year it seems like it's collapsed and it's not there. So it is likely that they move the rookeries around to some extent, although usually they will come back year after year, like you mentioned. So who knows exactly why the rookery collapsed. Maybe there's no food available for that for them in a particular area. Maybe there's additional or new predation pressure. Maybe there's some other type of pressure in terms of increased human activity. Who knows what it is, but it is interesting that we also saw a collapse of that one particular rookery near Jamie's house, and why we don't exactly know, but that's interesting that you're reporting the same thing.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting for you to pay attention to that rookery next year when you don't have all the leaf out. For me, yeah. This one that we were watching, I don't see the nests in the trees anymore, and I suspect a wind event, and we've had some strong winds, took out the nests. And as you mentioned, they will modify or improve existing nests and use the same nest year after year. And the nests just aren't there. And so I think there might have been a wind event that they've just taken up a different area. Yeah. And I still do see herons. So I think they're in the area, but just not the numbers.
Yeah. There you go, Mary Jo. Thank you for calling. Diane emailed to say they've had a mallard duck nest below their window for more than 4 weeks, wondering how long before the eggs hatch.
Yeah, so mallards, I'm going to take a little bit of a guess at this, but what will happen with mallards is they'll lay, let's say, 8 to 10 eggs. They lay, and she will lay an egg a day. Once they're all laid, then she will begin incubation. And that incubation period for a mallard, I'm going to say, is like 24, 25 days, somewhere in there.
Yeah, it's roughly a month.
Yep. And so she is probably, those eggs are probably very close to hatching, and that you maybe started observing her as she was still in the laying process. So add a couple days in there. Best thing you can do now is just stay away so you don't draw any attention to the nest. Keep pets and people away from that nest. Once they start hatching, within about 24 hours, they will all hatch, and she will lead them on the way to water. So,
there you go. Jim in Madison has a question or comment. Hi, Jim.
Yes. Thank you, Larry, for taking the call. I have a question about possums. Given the prevalence of tick-borne infectious diseases and the prodigious appetite that possums seem to have for ticks. I read once that a possum can consume up to 70,000 ticks in a given year. So given if that's only partially true, what can we do to encourage possums to be around?
All right, Jim. David, you got an answer to that?
Well, I'm not sure you need to encourage them because they are pretty common and pretty prevalent around the state, and they are beyond their traditional historical northern range. And so they typically are not necessarily common or native to this part of the United States because it's above their historic range, but they certainly have expanded their range. And I think, you know, they are scavengers. So the more roadkill and dead animals you have around, the more possums you'll have around likely because you've got the food source for them. It is possible that in certain areas, if you have an extreme cold weather event in the wintertime, that maybe a possum or the possum population may get knocked down a bit because they'll die of hypothermia. They're active year round throughout the winter and don't have much protection, especially on their ears and their tail, because that part of their body is not furred. I think the other thing is that they eat a lot of grubs. So if you've got that kind of habitat, that food source around, they like a lot of a fragmented habitat. So think about a residential community with neighborhoods. That is a wonderful habitat for possum. If you've got all those kinds of things, I think you should have possums, and perhaps you may have them and not be aware of it because a lot of times they're active at night primarily, not during the day. So they're around, we just may not see them. Yard, don't treat for those and don't eliminate or reduce the food source, and that should also attract the possums.
All right, there you go, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Troy in Windsor emailed to ask if there have been any wolverine sightings in Wisconsin.
Well, the answer to that is yes, there have been, but the sightings have always come back to a captive animal that escaped. When we talk about wolverines, and we usually say, you know, there hasn't been a sighting of a wild wolverine in Wisconsin for over 100 years. So again, similar to the fisher, native to the state, but extirpated during the time of European settlement. And they're a species that requires a very large home range and just not a species we would likely try to reestablish or reintroduce back into the state. And so we have not had wolverines for over 100 years. I remember Scott Craven, who's on every other month, talking about a wolverine sighting. I think it was on Beaver Dam Lake a number of years ago, decades, by ice fishermen. And it was a wolverine, but it was tracked back to a captive animal that had gotten out. So
why would anybody want to keep a wolverine?
I don't know. They're pretty mean. There's some Alaskan TV shows that, you know, they trap them on, and I've seen some of those episodes, and yeah, they are mean.
They are very mean. They don't like people very much.
No.
Scott and Spencer, we'll go to you. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Hey, I got a quick question. What is going on with all the seagulls and the pelicans up here in central Wisconsin? You see one, you see 1,000 seagulls. I mean, it's just fields are full, and with the pelicans also. So I was just wondering what the heck's going on.
Okay.
David, do you want to take it?
Well, yeah, I'll start. Okay. Yeah, for sure. So I would just gently mention that there is no species called a seagull, although that is common vernacular in the English language. I understand that. But it's likely, you know, the gull species that are the most common throughout the state typically is the ring-billed gull. And ring-billed gulls, wherever you have water, and especially if you've got trash that is not secured, ring-billed gulls will proliferate. And so I think the gull population is probably increasing, although I don't have data to support that. But I'm assuming that just based on my observations, the gull population, especially ring-billed gulls, are increasing in number simply because of the urbanization in the state. We've got a lot of good water habitat. Obviously, there's fisheries that they can take advantage of, things like that. And white pelicans as well are kind of a success story in terms of being recovered as a population. White pelicans were decreasing in numbers pretty heavily and have come back pretty nice to the point where, as you mentioned, some people are starting to get a little bit alarmed, especially if you fish, as to all the white pelicans that are in the state. And I think what you're seeing in the central part of the state is the white pelican population is growing and it's just expanding throughout other parts of the state where perhaps it hasn't been in recent years.
Deb in Trempealeau County emailed to say that feral cats are not part of nature, as are the feral pigs that were mentioned earlier. I'm wondering what can we do about the increasing number of feral cats who kill hundreds of wild native birds and other animals?
So, Deb, this is always a tough topic, and you're 100% correct in terms of likening it to feral pigs. But cat owners are a pretty powerful group and pretty protected of their right, you know, what they believe are the rights of their cats, right? So homeowners, to the point where I think that a lot of wildlife biologists really look at this, or at least the way I look at this question, is more in terms of cat ownership. And so I think about it in terms of if you kind of care about that cat, its livelihood, its lifespan is going to be much greater if that cat is kept indoors. So I think outdoor cats have half the lifespan of indoor cats. If you think about the disease risks, the injury risks, whether that be from, you know, human caused mortality from roads or from predators, you know, it's a much healthier situation. So if you buy into cats being domestic animals and pet ownership, I think that there's a lot that we can do from that standpoint in keeping them safe and indoors. Certainly there's a lot of research out there with cameras that cats wear around their neck, with what their activities are and what the number of small mammals and bird-related mortality looks like. So, again, we would look at that as a human-caused mortality, similar to window collisions or window strikes for birds, and something that we can certainly rally around and improve.
Yeah, for sure. Tom in Ellison Bay has something for us. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Larry. I was in Ellison Bay this week and saw two loons on the bay, and wonder if they would stay there through the summer because there's a lot of boats and stuff, or what, are they on their way somewhere else? And then the other question was, I posted a picture of these two loons on Facebook, and a friend in Connecticut said she wished they had loons in Connecticut. Would they have loons in Connecticut?
All right.
I'll take a gander at this. So, I'm not sure how far south the summer range of loons is in Wisconsin, but certainly I would think up in northern Wisconsin, there are loons up there. And I'm thinking about Lake Tomahawk, which is a area up by Kemp Natural Resource Station that Jamie and I spend time at over the course of the summer for a variety of programs. And Lake Tomahawk is a pretty busy lake in terms of boat traffic and things like that. My mom lives on a lake in central Minnesota, Gull Lake, which has nesting loons on it and loon families on it. And that is an extremely busy boat traffic lake in the summer. So I think that loons can adapt to that. There have been some studies in other areas of the country where they've demonstrated that human activity in terms of boat traffic and things like that will drive loons off of lakes. So I think it depends on probably those individual loons and in that particular lake. And I know loons are up in New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, areas like that. But I do believe that Connecticut is probably a little bit south where they would maybe see them as they fly through to migrate north or south. But they're probably not nesting on those lakes in Connecticut during the summertime.
Thanks very much for that question. Appreciate it very much. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today, they'll be with us right up until 12:30. At 12:30, our Wisconsin DNR new secretary, Karen Hyun, will be with us to answer your questions as well. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we will be back with David and Jamie. Thanks for being with us, and stay with us here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller. Well, it's our Wednesday wildlife conversation, and it is continuing, talking about a wide range of wildlife issues and behavior and how to keep what's wild, wild. Larry Mueller here with David Drake, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Knack, UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both affiliated with Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW Madison. And they are ready and able to answer your wildlife questions. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jenny in Verona has a question for us, so let's go there. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I have a duck in my backyard, and the bunny rabbits are having all kinds of babies underneath my deck. Is that a problem? Should I do something about it or just ignore it?
Between the duck and the bunnies?
Pardon me?
It was bunnies under their deck.
Yeah, but
yeah, deck, I think. Yeah.
Oh, deck. I got it. So with rabbits, cottontail rabbits, this is a common one where folks intending to help end up orphaning the young. And so what I mean by that is cottontail rabbits, the doe will give birth to those babies, and they will stay in a nest during the day. And the nest looks like just a shallow divot scratched out of the lawn or in some bark or mulch or under a bush, and maybe lined with fur from her body. And then during the day, that doe rabbit will be off somewhere else. She will only visit that nest a couple of times throughout the day, often at dusk and in the morning, and she'll nurse those young rabbits. Those rabbits have really large stomachs, so they can hold a large quantity of her milk, and so she doesn't have to be near them. And so one thing we do when people come across a nest full of bunnies, whether they're gardening or, you know, whatever they might be doing in the lawn, or maybe a dog indicates that there's a nest there, is to go ahead and back off and just observe from a distance. What you can do if you're not sure if that adult rabbit is coming back to the nest is take some small twigs and make a pattern of them, crisscrossing them over the top of those young, and then check the next day. And when you come back, if she's been nursing them, she will have moved all of that fur and those sticks off to the side so they can nurse, and then she'll cover them back up, but that pattern won't be in place anymore. And so that's a good way to see that they're still being taken care of before you scoop them up. But once those babies start leaving the nest, their eyes are open and they're moving and hopping around on their own, they are completely fine. You can just leave them be and enjoy watching them. So
okay,
I think in your situation, everything seems very normal, what you're describing.
All right. Jenny, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Lori in Tomahawk, it's your turn. Hi, Lori.
Yes, I'm calling about the great blue heron rookeries, and they used to be very, very common and numerous around the Tomahawk area, Lincoln County, Oneida, Vilas County. I spend a lot of time out in the woods, and all of them have been abandoned. It's also very rare to see a great blue heron compared to the old days, and this is all coincidental with the cranes reoccupying the area, as well as the fisher reintroduction, and a lot of other small mammals have also completely disappeared or much reduced in numbers up here.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'm not sure we can draw a cause and effect relationship with herons and increase in fishers and things like that. But it does sound like perhaps there's something to be looked at relative to heron rookeries and some of the heron numbers.
Oh, you're breaking up a little bit. Let's let
certainly check in with your. Yeah.
Well, just chime in, Lori, too. So there are a number of bird-related surveys. So the breeding bird survey, backyard bird counts that help also monitor trends in bird populations, and we could do some looking into that breeding bird survey data and see if there's any trend information related to great blue herons. But my point is there is a lot of work and survey work being done that I think we would start to hear about that being of concern. And I haven't heard anything at this point, but also it's very likely that for a variety of reasons, they relocated that roost. And so you might talk with others in your area. They may have some ideas on where that new location might be.
And I was thinking about southern Wisconsin, the Madison area. I see, often see great blues. We had one fishing off our pier commonly.
Yep.
We had there was a sort of a bluegill bedding area there next to the pier, which made for fun fishing with my daughter when she was quite young. But that heron was there, and I see them now around southern Wisconsin. I mean, and through the summer.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So there you go, Lori. But it's also I recognize her concern for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yep.
Joe in Medford just called to comment that a lot of cities now have trail cameras and post photos showing so much wildlife in metro areas, and in fact, there. You look around, there's a lot of wildlife in urban areas. No doubt about it. Ken emailed to ask if you have any information about the mice problem at Rock Island State Park. I haven't heard anything, but...
I remember seeing something brief about maybe some closures to facilities to deal with some infestation. Does that sound familiar? And it's been a while ago. Again, best source of information there is just to look on the Department of Natural Resources website and see if it is currently open. So just doing a search for that park name. And you could also call that switchboard number that Larry mentioned at the beginning of the show.
The grape jelly issue.
Yeah, this one's interesting, and I just thought it was worth bringing it up. I'm speaking on some press that was given to some hummingbirds that have been being brought into a wildlife rehabilitator in central Wisconsin in Antigo, the Raptor Education Group. And they had put out some press releases and a Facebook post just letting people know that they were taking in hummingbirds that were covered in grape jelly, some of which did not survive. And it was only, I mean, it was like three individuals, but just a cautionary note that maybe we're using grape jelly, you know, a little bit too much, or, you know, also
or maybe the
raising
containers,
awareness.
The containers that
so it gets on their feet, gets on their feathers, makes it really hard for them. But an interesting comment to that. So you can certainly continue to use, if you're trying to feed orioles or gray cat birds and other birds that are responding to grape jelly, you can still go back to the oranges. Reduce the amount of grape jelly that you're putting out there. Just be mindful of the birds coming into your feeders, taking a look at them. I'm sure nobody wants to have that happen to a hummingbird, so we all, you know, can appreciate the concern there. The other comment was that orioles are early migrants and later migrants, and hummingbirds are kind of in between. And so for folks that are feeding grape jelly for that high boost of energy, you could feed the grape jelly early in the season and then stop once the hummingbirds arrive and continue with the slices of orange and the orange halves and so on, and then pick it up again after the hummingbirds leave and the orioles are still there. You could add some more grape jelly if you're concerned about helping them during migration, giving them that boost of energy. So just something for us to be mindful of. And when we do feed birds, again, it's mostly for our own personal benefit. The birds don't necessarily rely completely on the food at feeders, but with feeding birds comes a responsibility for us to keep those feeders clean and change that hummingbird nectar, clean up spilled moldy seed, things like that. So just a FYI.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Mark in Madison called and couldn't stay with us. Mark said he's seeing a lot of low-flying birds in the morning. They're flying just above the curb height. He sees them while he's driving and doesn't understand why they don't fly higher. David, there's probably a good explanation for that.
I'm sorry, Larry, could you repeat the question? Excuse me.
Oh, there are a lot of low-flying birds in the morning that Mark is seeing just above the curb height while driving.
Oh, I gotcha.
And doesn't understand why they don't fly higher.
Yeah. That's a good question. And it probably depends on the bird. So I know robins, for example, will do that where they're flying close to the ground. And they're probably just doing short hops from maybe one side of the road to the next side of the road and don't want to expend any more energy than necessary. So the higher they fly, the more energy they have to expend. And if they're doing just a short hop, there's no necessity in flying high when you can just go straight across the road and just, you know, maybe raise your flight elevation by 6 inches to get across that curb into the next yard. So it probably is dependent on the species of bird and exactly what they're doing behaviorally.
Ken emailed to say their daughter lives in Jackson, Wisconsin, and reported an abundance of raccoons in the community. The raccoons are trapped and then moved out to a marsh outside of town, but they become a problem by attacking chickens and killing them.
Yeah, this raises a couple of, I guess, comments for me. So certainly urban wildlife, dealing with some of these nuisance wildlife, you can reduce that by eliminating food sources. Most of the time it's a food source that's bringing them in. So in this case, it could be chickens, right? So having a very fortified chicken coop is very helpful. You may need to keep those chickens in the coop 24 hours a day, or at least get them locked in before dusk and so on. And then also, if you have garbage, you're feeding pets outside, if you're feeding birds and there's spilled seed or access to grape jelly or, you know, fruits and things like that, those are all attractants that you might want to think about scaling back on and encouraging your neighbors to as well. The one couple concerns with trapping and relocating animals in Wisconsin, you do have to have permission of the landowner to release those animals. So you can trap them on your property, but releasing them is an issue if you don't have permission. So you can't just take them down to the state property or county park unless you have permission. Or if you have a private landowner who's got acreage and is willing to have that raccoons on their prop, you know, more raccoons on their property, you can do it then. And part of that is we're concerned about the humaneness of moving animals around, but also disease concerns and things like that. And then just one other note, we talked about keeping wildlife wild, and something that comes along with that is also being aware that this is baby animal season. And so now is not the best time to be trapping adults and either euthanizing them or relocating them, because you could be orphaning those young. And so we really want to be mindful that, yes, you've got that raccoon in a trap, but is it possible that there are young in the area as well? So something to consider.
To think about there. Yep. Yeah, for sure. Jean emailed to say they found two dead sparrows on the ground under their bird feeder. Both sparrows had pencil eraser-sized holes on their abdomens, and both were eviscerated. Any idea what might have done this? It didn't look like a cat attack.
David, did you hear that question?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. And I, you know, pencil-sized holes, that it could suggest somebody is maybe shooting them with a BB gun or a pellet gun, possibly, especially if they're trying to eradicate English or house sparrows, which I'm assuming that probably is the sparrow species she's talking about. But in the evisceration, once they fall to the ground, there's a number of animals that may be interested in eating them or scavenging on them, including possum, like we've talked about already. So it could be a number of things, but I would think that if it was a predator, they wouldn't just leave the animal like that. They would probably carry, especially if it was a Cooper's hawk or a sharp-shinned hawk, they likely would carry that bird off someplace else or eat it right there, but they'd probably eat more of it than what was found in the remains there. So yeah, that's a good question. I'm not exactly sure what would cause that hole, but there are a lot of people, unfortunately, that shoot birds, especially ghost sparrows, with BB guns and pellet guns, and that could be a possibility, especially in around houses and where people live.
Yeah.
And it could be a territorial thing too. So bluebird houses, it's not uncommon to find a bluebird killed in the nest box. A lot of times they'll peck the top of the head of the bird and kill it that way, whether that's a house sparrow, tree swallow, another bird trying to fight for that nest site location. So there could be some interspecies aggression going on too.
In late 2021, there was an outbreak, of course, of avian influenza, bird flu. It started spreading across North America, especially populations of domestic poultry and wild birds. How widespread is the problem now? David, do you have any?
Yeah. So it is still high path avian influenza or high pathogenic avian influenza, and what determines it being high pathogenic or low pathogenic is the number of domestic poultry that die from the disease. And so a number of years ago, we had a low path event. Now we're experiencing a high path event. And it is of concern, and it is being monitored quite closely, not only because of the impact it could have to the domestic poultry industry, but it is also starting to jump into dairy cattle across other parts of the United States. And so they're very concerned about that. Jumping species lines. From a wildlife standpoint, it can affect waterfowl in particular and raptors in particular, but there is a really good information through the Center for Disease Control, for example, and if you go to the U.S. Geological Survey National Wildlife Health Center, you can also find information, but they are keeping track of the species of wild birds that are being impacted, and although it is primarily raptors and waterfowl, there are increasing numbers of songbirds that are now starting to get impacted as well. Not that you need to be concerned about it, but if you are seeing avian influenza in your area, you should probably take your bird feeders down so we don't concentrate it and don't spread it in that particular area. But people are watching it very closely and are putting, especially on domestic farms, putting biocontrol into place as quickly as they can.
A couple of other things I wanted to touch on, and maybe Jamie, you can talk about the elk poaching case that was a very sad situation.
Yeah, so I just saw there was another round of press releases that the Department of Natural Resources issued. So they are still looking for tips and information on an illegal elk shooting. This occurred back in March. And they had Department of Natural Resources staff in the area in Jackson County. I believe they were looking to do some trapping and relocating a couple of animals in the area and also fitting them with GPS collars. And while they were in that area, they came across a deceased bull elk wearing a radio collar that had been shot, looked like it had sustained a gunshot wound. So they are still trying to solve that. They have added, there's been a couple of groups that have added and are offering a reward for information. So the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, who's invested lots and lots of financial resources for the elk reintroduction in Wisconsin, both in Clam Lake and in the Jackson County area. They're offering a $5,000 reward, and also the Wisconsin Buck and Bear Club is offering a $500 reward for information that leads to the successful prosecution of that incident. So this is unfortunately a bull elk known as number 244, and they do have it documented on trail cameras. It was a fairly commonly photographed elk by visitors and wildlife been watchers.
Been with us a long time, too.
Yeah, and it's been one of the primary breeding bulls for that central elk herd and one of the last remaining original elk from Kentucky. So if you do have information, you can remain anonymous, and there is both a Jackson County Crime Stoppers webpage that you can report or through the DNR's confidential violation hotline. That number is 1-800-847-9367.
And another point I wanted to bring up had to do with deer feeders and this spread of CWD, and we'll be probably talking with CWD a little bit with our Secretary of Natural Resources, Karen Young, but that's not a good thing to have.
Yeah.
Go ahead, David.
Yeah, there was a really interesting study that was just released through the Journal of Wildlife Management, where they looked at deer feeding from food plots, feeding stations, and I forgot the other type of deer feeder they were doing, but they essentially said when you're putting out piles of bait onto the landscape, that that is attracting and concentrating deer, as we know it does from baiting. But it also is increasing risky behavior in terms of spreading CWD prions across deer. And so there's an increased chance for CWD to spread at those bait stations relative to food plots and things like that. They also fenced out some bait stations so deer couldn't get to them, but raccoons could. And what they found is that raccoons, although raccoons are not susceptible to chronic wasting disease, raccoons will come to those bait piles, and they are picking up the prion in the soil or through deer urine or deer feces, and then they are spreading that across the landscape. So this is a relevant issue, and I know it's a sensitive issue for a lot of people who like to bait deer, either for hunting purposes or because they like to view deer. But baiting is very, very detrimental to deer health, especially in areas of chronic wasting disease. And as the news was released earlier this year, that chronic wasting disease is actually starting to drive down the deer population in the state of Wisconsin now, that deer baiting is probably one of the worst things we can do for the health of deer and deer population in the state of Wisconsin, as well as other places in the United States where chronic wasting disease is prevalent.
Let's finish on a high note here. We got a fun weekend ahead of us. The 13th annual free fun weekend for state parks.
Yeah. So the 7th and 8th is the free fun weekend. It's an opportunity to visit state parks without having to pay a visitation fee or have your state park sticker. You can also try your hand at fishing without having to have a fishing license. So lots of events around this free fun weekend. I really encourage you to look at the Department of Natural Resources events page for celebrations and opportunities in your area. So get out there and enjoy some of Wisconsin state parks and resources.
What better way to spend the weekend?
Yes,
for sure. Well, David and Jamie, thank you so much for joining us today. David Drake, a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Knack, a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both affiliated with Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Coming up, a talk to Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Secretary Karen Hyun. I'm Larry Mueller, and that's coming up next.